Fugitive.
I'm coming home, baby, now. I'm coming home now, right away. I'm coming home, baby, now. I'm sorry now I ever went away. Every night and day I go and stay. I'm coming home, baby.
Come on home.
Coming home, baby, now.
You know I'm waiting here for you.
I'm coming home now real soon.
You've been gone.
Hi, everybody, and home we are at last. Talking Fugitive with Kitty and Bobby and Ken back on. I'll tell you, these four-week breaks between programs are a bit of a challenge. When you get to be my age, you kind of celebrate living for another 4 weeks.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
We made it, though, anyway, and we are back to talk more Fugitive. And tonight, just as the opening music said, coming home. That's what we're going to be talking about. This episode, or tonight's program, rather, concerns the final program on part one of the episode, The Judgment. So without further preparatory statements on my part, let's go right to the host and Bobby Neer.
Thank you, Dave. When 1940s, 50s, and 60s jazz, blues, and pop icon singer Mel Torme recorded tonight's opening song back in 1962, he was presumably singing about going home to his girlfriend. But as we begin the final act of The Judgment Part 1, Richard Kimball is also on his way home, only he already has his girlfriend with him. He just doesn't quite realize it yet. Since the series began more than 4 years ago, we've all known that one day Kimball would need to return to the scene of the crime, back in Stafford, Indiana, to get to the bottom of the crime. Now with the one-armed man having been in temporary police custody, and a new name thrown into the mix as a possible witness in the form of Leonard Taft, Kimball's brother-in-law, there may never be a better time. The only question is, will Kimball come back home on his own or connected by handcuffs to Gerard? This final act of The Judgment, Part 1, will answer that. But first, we have some unfinished business. As our last show ended, Ken could be heard in the background calling my name and saying, that kiss, Bob, we need to talk about that kiss. Ah, yes, that kiss. That comes as Jean Carlisle is preparing to leave her apartment as a decoy to get the cops and Gerard out of the area and off Kimball's back, while he stays behind and prepares to head out of L.A. and back to Stafford. Suddenly, Richard grabs her arm and twists and squeezes it hard in some sort of bizarre apparent wrestling move that Mickey Rourke could have used in the current hit film, The Wrestler, and the two share this god-awful, passionless, hard kiss, proving once and for all what we've known all along, that these two have absolutely no screen chemistry at all. Don't think so? Well, compare this to several moments of passion from the past, like Karen coming over to sit on Kimball's lap and blow in his ear as part two of Never Wave Goodbye begins, to say nothing of the final goodbye kiss on the beach at the end of Never Wave Goodbye, and Kimball's final goodbye embrace and kiss of a soaking wet and still absolutely gorgeous Karen. Well, for that matter, Kimball's goodbye kiss with Ellie Burnett as he waits for a bus at the conclusion of World's End. After that kiss, Ellie even says to him, "You never kissed me like that before." Or Kimball's little tryst on the beach with none other than Angie Dickinson as the waves rush over them, and especially on the couch in her apartment in Brass Ring, and even with Barbara Wells in Season 4's The Walls of Night, as the two sit cuddled and snuggled up together in a chair in a motel room with her practically buried in Kimball's lap. Compare those to this, and you'll see what I mean. Ken, since you brought it up, take a couple of minutes to tell the world just how turned on you were by this sizzling, hotter-than-hot, unforgettable, stimulating moment of passion.
Oh, well, Bob, I have to rate this kiss not only, you know, the kiss between Richard Kimball and Jean Carlisle at the end of part one, just before the final scene there. I have to rate this kiss between these two people not only the worst kiss in the entire Fugitive 120 episodes, but the worst kiss in the history of television altogether.
Now, Ken, am I correct that Jean Carlisle is the woman who makes men happy to be executed?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
I don't think I've seen a worse kiss in all the TV shows I have ever seen, and I've been watching for maybe 54 years.
Me too.
What was that? I mean, Jean, you know, she's been getting closer and closer throughout the whole episode ever since she, you know, first saw him at the market. And she's been getting closer, you know, leaning over. And at the zoo, she finally got to, you know, hold hands a little bit and grab his arm and walk and get closer. She did have that moment when in the middle of the night, Kimball was you know, wondering what to do, and she got up in her robe. That was a little close moment, but she didn't make the move. But right toward when she has to leave, she leans closer, and then Kimball just turns around, grabs her arm, and lays a big one on her, and I almost fell off my couch when I saw it. I say, what was that?
Kelly? It's every woman's dream come true to be grabbed like that and have your arm broken that way. Kitty, how did you feel about that?
Well, to me, the whole love story angle between Richard and Jean in this story seemed to me very forced. You plopped these two actors into this script like geraniums, and they hoped that they could create some screen chemistry, and they really didn't. I mean, because the focus of the episode is really supposed to be about Kimball trying to get himself free, not getting sidetracked by a love interest. And I think that by having a love interest, that detracts from the story. I think it would have been a much more interesting story if Jean had done everything for purely altruistic reasons and was just doing it as a family friend. You know, so, you know, one of the reasons why I always thought the episode "The End Is But the Beginning" worked well was because Amy just did what she did to help him out as a friend. I mean, because they never got to the point of getting to go out on a date, but yet I thought that everything about her came across as very genuine. And here, Jean just seems to want to be his boyfriend or his girlfriend.
Well, yes, and we talk about somebody doing or helping him for altruistic reasons. You can go back to Margaret Ruskin in Escape into Black. There's no romance there, and she simply helps him, and at the very end helps him escape just as Gerard's about to grab him. So you don't necessarily have to have a love story involved just because there's a woman, but, you know, that was the thinking back then. And it really wrecks the entire... actually, both parts of the story, especially part one. This is where, to me, there's a great failure here in not bringing back somebody from the past. Now, you know, if you don't want to bring back Karen, there are other people. There's Ellie Burnett, like I mentioned. There's Amy. There's other people that could have been brought back as a possible love interest. There would have been a connection that way. And when you get to this scene where they finally break down and embrace, it has some meaning. And we can relate to it and look at it and go, well, yes, of course. Because throughout the series, Richard Kimball runs into many beautiful women, but all of his relationships are doomed to failure. He's the man on the run. He can't stay around. He can't take them with him, so it's not going to work. So we all know that. This doesn't even work as a one-night stand. It just doesn't work at all. And Ken is right. I mean, this is I don't know where the direction is. I don't know whether this was David Janssen's decision to do it this way or the director told him, grab her arm and do this, but it just doesn't work. I mean, there's no tenderness in it. There's no feeling in it. It's just, you can almost, even though you don't see it and you don't hear it, you can almost imagine the director standing right in front of them and telling them exactly what to do, but the actors in the scene don't believe it. I mean, sometimes you'll see a movie or even a scene on TV where you wonder if there really isn't something real between the two, but that doesn't even come close here. Ken, you stand by that? This is just about the worst you've ever seen.
Well, I agree with you on if you're going to have a love interest or a love story, it has to be developed. I hate that when you watch a movie or a television show and then you get, you know, two lovers together And you feel uncomfortable watching it because it's not genuine, you know, either, like you said, a one-night stand or something.
Right.
In The Fugitive, they could have had a genuine love story, and then you feel for these characters. You know, the Barbara Wells and the Walls of Night, if they had done that about episode 110,
right,
bring her back 115,
right,
118, and then she shows up in The Judgment, you care about her. Kimball cares about her, work her into the story. Then then the love story is good, and then when they have a kiss, you know, you enjoy it. You know, you enjoy watching it. I did not enjoy this aspect, and especially toward the end of part one, especially with the whole fugitive four-year odyssey that I've been watching. It just ruined it for me, and I was just so, you know, taken back by it.
To wonder why writers would even bring this in, like Kitty mentioned, into the story when we're at the most compelling moment. We're at the end of the series now, and the most important thing is for Kimball to prove that he's innocent before Gerard drags him back to death row and he gets executed. All of this other stuff is trivial. It simply doesn't belong in here at all. It's taking up time, and it's taking the focus away from the only really important thing. When it was like earlier in the episode, we talked about another show, when they go into her apartment and she's telling him the story about her father and her family. I mean, this kind of stuff. I mean, you got to be kidding me. Why are the writers killing time? Do they feel like obviously they have nothing to give because they're just wasting valuable time. So here you've got Kimball and Jean Carlisle's apartment. Gerard is right outside. He's in the street pacing back and forth. You got to wonder whether or not he's going to break down the door at any moment and grab Kimball. And I want to be really, really worried at this point. I don't want to sit here and watch this ridiculous moment. And it's so idiotically contrived. It just doesn't make any sense.
Do you think there's any possibility that Kimball is actually trying to deliberately get so many of these women pregnant that they won't execute him simply so that he can make the father support
him? No, I don't think so, because in 1960s television, nobody had sex and nobody got pregnant.
All right,
so
okay.
That was really not an issue. So,
well, actually, that did happen in a couple of episodes, just with other people.
Like who?
Well, in that not so great episode with Andrew, where Andrew Prine came back as the creepy boyfriend, and he had gotten a girl pregnant, you actually had an episode about an unwed mother in that episode.
Well, that was daring.
Yeah, and then the episode with William Shatner, they had the scene with him and his wife, and they were actually sort of in bed together.
Oh, I know.
Everybody else gets to do it except Richard Kimball.
You know, that's a good point, and I mentioned all those moments from the past that were better than this. You're right. That particular scene was, I remember we discussed it when we did our reviews. Ken, do you remember that with William Shatner?
Yes, I remember that episode. Julie Summers?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
they were actually in bed together. I mean, there was actually some heat coming off the screen.
Yeah.
If you compare that to this, it becomes actually even more laughable than ever.
So see, my ideas aren't so half-baked after all. Listen, we're halfway through this already, and I know you're just getting warmed up. Let's take a quick time out, and then we'll come back, and we'll get to hear, you know, Ken regale us some more about what he considers sloppy tongue down the throat stuff and other aspects when we talk Fugitive here on the other side of the break. We'll be right back in just a minute on Retro Radio.
If you've enjoyed talking Fugitive over the last few years, then be sure to stick around when KSAV will bring you a new program based on the television classic Twilight Zone. Same episode-by-episode analysis, same in-depth discussion, same interesting and provocative hosts. And it takes place at the same time and channel, so no adjustment of either your computer or your schedule is required. Just keep listening every other Tuesday to KSAV, the reason your computer came with speakers.
I'm coming home, baby, now. I'm coming home now right away. I'm coming home, baby, now.
Hey, that Twilight Zone shut down. Great. You know, I'm going to stick around for that myself.
I've never seen the thing, but I hear it's pretty good.
All right. Well, we're going to find out in the near future, but we're back now to talk a little more talking fugitive. So let's get right back to it. And Bobby Nair, you take over again, please.
Okay, Dave. About a month ago, the entire country was in an uproar over the inauguration of our first African-American president, but that was nothing compared to the uproar that has ensued since with the publication of our latest The Fugitive Views and Reviews book. In Volume 4, our fourth and final book, all 30 episodes from Season 4 are reviewed, analyzed, and summarized by the three co-hosts of this very radio program, including extended reviews of the series finale, The Judgment, and guest reviews from four longtime group members. Also included in this volume are two original Fugitive fan fiction stories written by Kitty, who I might add should have written The Judgment. Lists of our 10 worst and 10 best episodes from the entire series, poll results for Season 4, and final poll results for all four seasons, and best to worst episode poll results listed from number 1 to 120. The book also concludes with a newly written epilogue by me. At 386 pages, this is our biggest and most comprehensive volume, along with our three previous books, a must-have for any serious Fugitive fans collection. Available now all over the Internet at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and other fine Internet booksellers, along with our three previous volumes, the entire series is now covered. The economy is bad and getting worse, according to the president, so we urge you to buy these books now while you still have any disposable income left at all. Don't wait for the federal government bailout. There's nothing in there about a subsidy for purchasing books, although by now there might be. Everything else in the world is in there. And lastly, a programming note. Due to a scheduling conflict, our next program that will begin a discussion of Part 2 of The Judgment will be 4 weeks from tonight rather than the usual two. Make that March the 10th when we begin our discussion of The Judgment Part 2, 4 weeks from tonight on Talking Fugitive. Okay, gang, let's cut to the chase. Oh, my, did I say chase? How silly of me. After that deadly embrace, Gene leaves Kimball behind in her apartment. He's heading back to Stafford, but first he calls for a cab and waits. Well, I'm waiting, too. The hour is almost up, and it's a no-brainer that in order to get the audience to come back next week for Part 2, there's going to be one hell of a chase scene to end this part. How can it miss? After all, Gerard is pacing directly outside the apartment, at one point staring up at the window from the street. At the same time, Kimball is sneaking a peek out from behind the curtains. Gerard has found that box of apples from the produce market in Gene's car, so he knows something is up. Finally, Kimball's cab pulls up outside. Aha! I'm thinking to myself, here it comes, the chase to end all chases. I let my imagination run wild. Maybe Gerard commandeered the cab up the street, and a cop is driving it now while Gerard hides in the back seat. Kimball gets in, Gerard grabs him, but Kimball manages to jump out, and a desperate chase through the streets of L.A. ensues. Or if you don't like that, maybe Gerard is hiding in the dark in the back seat. Kimball gets in only to have Gerard slap handcuffs on him while repeating that famous, memorable line from North Oak, "Finally, Kimball, finally." There are endless possibilities, and I gave my own extended version of one exactly like that in my review of this episode, with the scene in Part 1 ending with Kimball and Gerard face-to-face in the back seat. The screen immediately changes to a view outside the cab, and we watch helplessly as it roars off into the distance, its taillights quickly disappearing into the darkness. Fade to black, no epilogue, credits roll, that's it, leaving us all sitting on the edge of our seats for the next 7 days, wondering what happened next. The only problem is I'm not writing this story, so what I want or expect means nothing, and the writers give me exactly that, nothing. Kimball comes sauntering out of the building like he doesn't have a care in the world. His cab is waiting. Suddenly, Gerard comes out of the darkness with his gun drawn. But look carefully, it's not pointed at Kimball. Instead, it's pointed at the ground. Gerard tells the cabbie to leave, and Kimball just stands there, when he easily could have wheeled around and taken that overnight bag he's carrying and knocked Gerard flying. The gun would probably have fired, but at the ground, and then you have your chase scene. I can almost understand this playing out as it does if Gerard had come up silently behind Kimball, placed his gun right up against his neck and snarled in his ear, "Finally, Kimball, finally," Kimball would have been nailed on the spot. But no, nothing of the kind happens. Instead, we get Kimball immediately trying to strike a deal with Gerard to give him time, because he's finally close to something. Gerard tells him he's sorry, but Kimball knew it would happen someday and that he just ran out of time. What Gerard should have said was, sorry, but the writers just ran out of ideas. Holy crap! I've waited 4 years for this? I was only 20 years old when this played out in front of me, and I had not seen all that much at that time. So perhaps I was just anticipating too much. But in the more than 42 years that have gone by since, I have yet to see a single scene or moment in a TV series or a feature film that has left me feeling more empty and more deprived than this. It is absolutely appalling that a TV series basically about one man chasing another relentlessly across the country should end part one like this with no style whatsoever and not a bit of tension created at this critical moment. Now, from this moment on, nothing that might happen in part two can make up for this. It's over as far as I'm concerned. I gave this episode a zero rating. I should have given it a minus 10 because no low number is low enough to properly register my contempt for how this ends. Kitty, your take on this, please?
Well, I was a little bit kinder to the episode than you were. I gave it a 6, but that was because of other things that happened in it, not because of this ending. I thought this ending was very lame. You know, once again, it shows, really, it kind of illustrates why Gerard kept losing Kimball all those times, because Gerard was basically seeing himself as this one lone maverick cop that was after Kimball. It never occurred to him to take backup. And you would think, in this particular instance, that if he knows that Kimball's going to come walking out that door, you would think he would have had at least 20 cops all hiding in the bushes so that when Kimball came out, they'd all come out with guns pointed directly at his head.
Where's the LA SWAT team?
Exactly. And yet, and then, you know, Gerard could just calmly come up and slap the cuffs on him, but here it's just Gerard, and he's just holding his gun very limply in his hand. I mean, it's like it's because he knows Kimball ain't going to do anything. And it's like, you know, we have seen Kimball all this time just take so much garbage off of Gerard. I mean, it would have been so satisfying if we could have at least seen Kimball hit him or knock him down or kick him or do something at this point. You know, it's like after all of this, after all the times he's saved Gerard's backside, and this is how Gerard shows his gratitude, you could at least give Kimball the satisfaction of being able to punch his lights out and run off and have a real cat and mouse chase game that gets continued into the next episode.
But then he might have been charged with assaulting a police officer.
It doesn't matter.
He's
on his way to death row anyway.
Going to the death house.
You think he's just a criminal then?
He's got nothing to lose.
Huh.
Ken, what do you think?
Well, Kitty, if you remember Nightmare at North Oak, Kimball did clobber Gerard on the back. Remember in the cell?
Yes, that is true. Gerard fell for the old Western trick. You see that played out in the Westerns all the time. So that was actually satisfying. But that was before he started saving him left and right. He'd only saved him once up until that point. Then he saved him all those other times. I mean, this just got really annoying.
Bob, you forgot something.
What?
Don't you remember that at the beginning of the episode, we saw this scene already in the spoiler segment?
Oh, well, that I absolutely despise that. I don't even talk about that. That's horrible.
Oh, would you believe, Dave, you won't believe it, but they gave away the end.
That is the most absurd thing that's ever been done in the history of TV.
Yeah. They show the very first thing, you tune in to watch The Judgment, the whole country is watching.
Right.
43 million people or whatever it is. And here it is, The Fugitive is on, and they show a spoiler segment, and the scene is Kimball walking out the front door. Bob, I need to ask you, why is a fugitive walking out the front door, not the back door?
Well, you're right, Gene told him there's no back entrance. So if there's a fire in the building, nobody's getting out.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very stupidly designed building, because Gene said there was no back entrance, which is just... ridiculous. You know, it's like you're telling me the city of Los Angeles didn't have fire codes back then.
The writer just completely forgot that.
Ken, what I want to know from you is, what did you expect to happen before this came about?
As far as the end of part.
Uh-huh. What did you think was going to happen?
Well, the spoiler ruined everything.
But forget about that. You must have had some idea in mind before it ever came on TV. How you think? Didn't you expect something big like I did?
I wanted a car chase. That's what I wanted.
Chase
through the city. I wanted a big crash.
Fine.
I wanted Kimball to be in that crash, and the car is burning. He gets out limping, and I want Gerard in the background coming out of the dust and the fire, saying, "I've got you, Kimball."
Oh, I love it. Okay, that's fine.
Well, you know, the worst part. Bloodthirsty bunch you are.
Yeah, we are bloodthirsty.
All right.
The worst part about this is the fact that in the past, in four years for that series. Kimball never acts like this at all. I mean, there are numerous episodes where he does just about anything he can to escape. I mean, look at Escape in the Black, where he jumped off a moving train. I mean, in real life, he would have been killed. He never would have survived that. Look at the 2130, late in season 3, which was nothing but about being chased. Kimball running across the railroad yards, just barely getting away. I mean, there are all kinds of instances where Kimball has done anything and everything he needed to do to get away. So it's inconceivable that at the end of this, at the series now, he decides to just stand there. Now, I've read in a few other places that the idea is that they're both tired. They're both exhausted. They can't stand to run anymore.
Well, I don't know about
I'm
you.
I'm not buying
but if,
that.
But if my alternative is to run or to be carted off to death row, I think I'd somehow be able to find the energy to keep running.
Right. The sense of self-preservation that all human beings have would kick in. You're not going to just stand there. I mean, if you're in the middle of a fire or something, you're not just going to stand there and go, well, I guess I'll just burn to death. You're going to try to get out. That's what we all do. We're always trying to survive. So it figures, I don't care how tired Kimball is, he's not going to just stand there and go, well, you know what, I just can't run down the street anymore, or I can't get in that big car chase that Ken is figuring is going to happen.
He's just going to stand there.
It's absurd.
Hey, Bob, what if Kimball, at that moment when Gerard comes out, he turns his back on him and says, "You're going to have to shoot me in the back."
And that would have been an interesting, yeah.
Would Gerard have shot him in the back?
That's a good question. He almost shot him in the back in Trial by Fire. Remember when Kimball jumped out the fire escape?
I think he would have shot him.
Yeah, because Kimball was running down the street, and Gerard took his gun, and he looked outside the window, and he shot right at him. That was shooting in the back. There's no question about that. So that would have, look, let's be honest about it. You don't even have to be a professional writer to come up with all kinds of different things here that would have been more exciting. I have no idea what they were thinking. I think that they just wanted to get to part two. They stacked it up. They knew what they were going to do in part two, and they figured all we need to do is get there. I say that's ridiculous. You know, and you mentioned the ratings earlier, but part two of The Judgment actually got bigger ratings than part one got. Which makes me wonder, what were people thinking? You didn't think you had to watch part one to get to part two? So there were a lot of people out there who only wanted to know how he got caught. They didn't want to know what happened up until that time. It wasn't really important.
You know, Bob, I'm wondering how many people turned their TV sets off when they saw the spoiler and said, oh, well, I guess we don't need to see the episode. Let's see what else is on TV.
There was a time back in the 60s where TV shows were doing that, and I swear I used to think to myself, I don't even believe this is happening.
All right, now swearing's a bad habit. We've had enough of it here during this discussion. All right, folks, we'll give you 4 weeks to kind of calm down and digest all of this, and we won't spoil it by telling you what's going to come up in 4 weeks. But we will be back to talk more of The Fugitive. It will be part one of part two on The Judgment when we return on March the 10th. Hope you'll be here with us. Once again, talking Fugitive on Sherevision Radio.
Come on home.
I'm coming home, baby, now.
You know I'm waiting at the door.
They can't hold me back now no more.
All alone.
I'm pressing on, baby, now.
And pacing up and down the floor.
Oh, hear me holler and hear me roar.
Say you'll be with me.
Gonna be with you evermore. I'm coming home.
Come on home.
I'm coming home, baby, now.
Oh, baby, say you're coming home.
That's what I say. I say I'm coming home.
Something's wrong.
road is long, baby, now.
Or to either ride or bump.
I'm coming home and never more to roam.
Baby, tell me you're
baby, I'm for sure coming.